And a very good afternoon to you. We've got a full house today. Richard Collins is here, Aina Nilana, and Ken Whelan is here. Ken, you're just back from northern Russia. What were you doing there?
I was up on the Kola Peninsula working with some colleagues of mine from the Polar Research Institute, and I got an opportunity to go into some of the upper reaches of the better salmon rivers, and it was absolutely fascinating. We were surveying lakes and rivers and looking to see how extensively they were used by salmon. So it meant we had to hop around the place using a helicopter and look at various rivers and survey them with electrical fishing gear and see whether or not there were salmon present. And
survey them for who?
Survey them for the Polar Research Institute and for the owners of the river. And they actually have an interesting system in Russia where some of the better salmon fisheries are actually leased or sold to private owners. And in this case, it's actually a Russian man who owns these four rivers and all of the catchments. So they were very keen
to make sure. One person owns a river?
Absolutely. Well, four rivers.
The entire stretch of river?
The entire stretch of river,
I mean,
yeah.
It's like somebody's, it's like saying somebody owns the Shannon and it's not the state.
And its catchment.
Well, there's quite a lot of salmon fisheries in Ireland that are privately owned.
No, nobody owns the Shannon.
No, not one river.
Not one individual, I mean.
Well, these were big catchments as well. I mean, we're looking at very large areas. The main rivers themselves aren't that huge. But the catchment areas up in the tundra where they go off into all these little fingers, I was amazed just how extensive they were. And it was very different to anything I've ever seen before. It was like a massive version of the Burren, in that there was loads and loads of tundra area, which looked very much like our blanket bog. And then in between all these little pockets of water, little pools, lakes, rivers running in between. So it was really fascinating.
And was it all acid?
It wasn't, surprisingly, and that's what really blew my mind. The main channels coming out of the tundra area and flowing down very fast valleys, those areas had cut through the softer rock and they were in very hard rock. But in the upper areas, and I realised this the first day when we were flying over some of the lakes themselves are very shallow. Because of that, the light can get to the bottom. And they seem to be sitting on what looks like limestone type area, and there seems to be a lot of nutrients in the water. There's a lot of a substance called apatite in that area, which is calcium phosphate. So you have calcium and you have phosphate, so you have lots of nutrients to make sure that the water is rich. The one thing that's limiting it is the cold. I mean, the area, the time they have available to them to grow is very limited. Very lucky to see the ice gone off those lakes by the end of May. And the time I was there 2 or 3 weeks ago, it was closing down really for the winter. It was autumn. So very, very short season, but lots of food about for the fish during that time.
And there are people coming up there fishing and paying a premium, presumably, to fish up there, are there?
Paying very substantial amount of money, yeah. They've done a really good job at developing locations for people to stay in and so on, which are sustainable from an ecological point of view. The areas where people are actually camping out have now been developed from being originally tented camps into a situation now where they're cabins. But the cabin areas are all on stilts and they're above even the tundra area where the camps are located. And the whole thing is based on a leave no trace basis so that people don't do any damage if at all possible in terms of their activities. But the contrast between the success of the salmon at sea in that area and what we're going through in Western Europe was extraordinary. The fish, the adult salmon, were in amazing condition. They'd obviously done really well at sea, and this year they had caught several salmon over 40 pounds in weight in these rivers. So particularly big, long-lived fish.
Did you catch any yourself, Ken?
Yes, I did. Obviously, did a little bit of fishing in the evening time, and was lucky enough to get some really quite substantial fish.
What's your biggest?
My biggest on that trip was 10 kilos, 22 pounds.
And did you put it back?
Oh, God,
yeah, it went back. Yeah.
And would they go to sea several times, or did they just come ashore once, come in upriver once, breed, and then die?
I was really, again, I was amazed because in Ireland, it's unusual enough to have a salmon spawn more than once. Even spawning twice is really a rare occurrence. They have recorded some of these big fish have spawned up to four times. So the whole system is based on a situation where it's to do with long life. So if you make it, the environment then makes sure that you make it subsequently several times. But it makes it very sensitive because everything is around this very narrow pyramid. And if you damage that pyramid, my sense of it was that it wouldn't have a lot of resilience. Here we'd have, in our rivers and lakes, we'd have a lot of backup. A lot of things could actually tend to support any big problem. If you have big pollution or if you had an acid spill or whatever. In those situations, there's a lot being banked on those very old fish, and really they need to be conserved very carefully.
Is there permafrost there?
Yes, they have. They've permafrost in some of the higher areas. The area we were in, no, but there's a mountain range which is slightly higher than the area we were in, where they do have permafrost.
And of course, if that goes with climate change, that's going to have a huge impact.
Well, we picked up on something that I thought was really interesting, which I don't think had been picked up on before. As I flew into the camp on the first morning, I was really surprised at the strange colour in the water. And that afternoon, when we were doing our first survey, I realised that the rocks had quite a lot of green algae on them. Not to the extent that you'd be worried about it, but it was a lot more than I would have expected in what is apparently a barren area. And I remarked on this to some of the biologists working with me. And they mentioned that they had photographs from maybe 20 years ago, some underwater photographs of the algae. And we looked at that. And when we compared it, what we realised was that the densities of algae on the rocks is now much, much higher than it had been about 20 years ago. And we started to think about this in relation to climate change and in terms of warming and perhaps a drop in terms of the actual thickness of the ice and light getting through at an earlier stage. So you have a mix there where you have the nutrients in the water, and potentially if you have a marginal increase in terms of temperature, you could have greater releases of nutrients down into the rivers. So it's something they have to watch very carefully, is this natural increase in terms of the algae on the rocks.
Ken, you said something I don't understand. You said they're relying on these older fish. They've got to look out for them because they're spawning up to four times.
Yeah.
And here it's uncommon for a fish to spawn more than once.
Yes.
It's knackered. It's all over.
It's gone.
It spawns, it dies.
Yeah.
Well, what about the new ones that are coming out in that river in Russia? Surely it's spawning and four times, and they're breeding the best and the strongest fish.
Yeah, good point. Except the turnover rate, I should have mentioned that. The turnover rate in southern Europe, for example, is very fast. So you get very large numbers of juvenile fish, the vast majority of which go to sea at 1 or 2 years of age. Then you get large numbers of salmon coming back after 1 year in the sea, and some salmon coming back after 2-3 years in the sea. Whereas in Russia, some of the salmon par can stay for as long as 6 years in freshwater before they go to sea. So the whole cycle in freshwater is so much slower that in reality, you don't have anything like the population base in terms of juveniles as you would have.
But why are they staying longer in the freshwater? The conditions must be perfect. They don't need to leave.
The big issue is the growth period. Here we have salmon growing almost 12 months of the year at this stage with climate change. Whereas in that time, the juveniles are only growing between, let's say, you know, in any substantial way, the end of May right through to September.
Well, no, you're blaming the climate change for the salmon growing 12 months of the year. I mean, was that not happening before? Can you tell me that? Oh, if you go back 20 years, they weren't growing the same way?
Well, we know we have very good and published scientific evidence now to indicating clearly that we do have a big increase in terms of the numbers of salmon going to sea after 1 year now, whereas the vast majority of them used to go to sea after 2 and 3. And we can link that in directly in terms of warmer conditions during the winter period.
So they've grown enough in 1 year now to be able to go to
sea.
Because presumably you're a certain size before you can go to sea. And before, because the situation was different, it took 2 or 3 years. And in Russia, it takes 4 or 5 years before they go to sea.
In some cases.
Okay, so why then do they come back knackered? The Irish ones, let's say.
Well, the Irish ones, they, because they come back as grilse, they come back in absolutely prime condition coming back at grilse. They've only been 1 year at sea.
Yeah.
They're in really tip-top condition. They produce really viable, good-conditioned eggs. And in reality, because they fill all the spaces, nature really doesn't see a requirement, I presume, to have lots of fish coming back after 1, 2 or 3 spawnings. You normally get a drop-off in terms of the numbers of eggs and the viability of the eggs when they spawn several times. The best eggs are the eggs that come out on the very first the very first spawning. So everything in the south is geared towards quick turnover. In the north, my sense of it is that very much regulated by those temperature regimes. We may see a very different environment if we do see significant climate change in those areas. And certainly it's those Arctic areas where climate change is likely to have the biggest impact.
Ken, that's a cold part of the world. I mean, the little par living in rivers, when it goes dark for 24 hours in winter, it must get extremely cold. How do they manage up there? The river must freeze a lot of the time. So how does the little par cope? Is that one of the reasons why it's so slow to grow and taking its time?
Yes, it certainly is. the rivers themselves do get a sheet of ice on them. Nothing as dense as the ice that you'd get in the top in the tundra itself. But there's a lot of flowing water, so the fish themselves don't have a difficulty in terms of oxygen. They would certainly have a difficulty in terms of light. Again, I think, as the adult salmon do, they're really good at going into a sort of topper where they can actually manage and tick over very slowly. They're obviously running with the same temperature as the water. Their body temperature is linked in with the temperature of the water directly. They don't have to maintain a particular temperature. So basically their whole metabolism drops in, as a consequence, and then they'll move back into the zone then where they can feed once the temperature starts to go up.
Now, Bergman's rule, the famous Bergman's rule, says that the colder an environment, the bigger an animal tends to be. It has to be, because it retains heat better if it's big than if it's small. Could this explain why you were catching 22 kilo? I mean, you caught a 22 kilo salmon here.
Does that apply to animals in water as well?
I just want to ask, if can that, is this a reason why your fish would be larger there?
It may be. Remember now, these fish, certainly the 40 pound, 20 kilo fish that they catch in these rivers, they're making that growth at sea. They're not, obviously not making it in freshwater. But certainly in the context of the freshwater fish like the Arctic char and so on, that may very well explain why you have these very long-lived and these bigger creatures. It may be a very good strategy.
Our char are very tiny little thing. How big is a char up there?
Well, certainly we got char up to, in centimetres, up to about 55 centimetres just in our short survey work. But there are bigger char than that. Most of the char in Ireland would be 8 to 20 centimetres. They're very tiny little
Has
creatures.
Has it not to do with space?
Yeah, it may have to do with space.
You know, you have lots of people living in a small little flat. Are they going to be as tall as lots of people living in a huge mansion? I'm just wondering.
It's Bergman's rule. It's Bergman's rule.
Don't mind the rule. I'm just asking.
Is that not to do with warm-blooded creatures who are losing heat? I mean, obviously, fish are cold-blooded creatures and they're the temperature of their surroundings. So would Bergman's rule apply to them at all? Because it has to do with the actual body temperature relative to holding on to your heat in spite of the colder surroundings, which warm creatures
Heat to drive any muscle. I mean, we were looking at the great whites. Now, their temperature rises very high in the muscles, although they're cold-blooded in the South Seas. You do need temperature, and temperature is an issue for any creature anywhere. And if it gets very cold, they may have a problem. That's why I raised that particular issue with Ken, to know if that was the case. Now, when they go out to sea for the winter, it's a frozen Arctic sea. Where do they go? Do they head over towards Norway into the Atlantic? Or
let me step back a bit just to mention as well, because it could support your view. One of the reasons that these massive salmon do so well in those rivers is because of the physical barriers that are there. So there were huge barriers on some of these rivers. So you need really big, powerful fish just to be able to move upstream. So that's a big advantage to them, to be very powerful.
Barriers
very
like
big.
What, Ken?
Natural rock barriers. One of the rivers now had 6 waterfalls on it. So to get up to the top at all, these fish have to be very big and very powerful. And thankfully, nowhere did we see any interference from man.
So no salmon ladders or anything
like
that?
No, nothing like that. And in the upper catchment...
Is that what they call them? Salmon stairs?
Yeah,
salmon ladders.
And no dams either.
No dams, no interference. And it was such a pleasure to see something that was untouched.
Natural.
One interesting example, I'll get back to the sea in a moment, but one interesting example of the sort of approach that you would take if you were a biologist from Southern Europe. If you went in there and the first lake we surveyed was full of pike, and this was quite surprising to me because I thought these would be pristine, pure waters without these pike and perch and so on. The next lake had perch in it. And the next lake had whitefish. And the next lake had char, trout and whitefish and some pike. So all of these fish species, which as fishery managers, we might be inclined to manage, inverted commas, that's another word for mess with, in terms of removing or stocking or whatever. They haven't been touched up here. And they keep in this balance. And when some of the surveys are done, the pike and the perch have encroached a certain amount into other lakes and so on. Then you get a very harsh winter and they retreat again. And we had an interesting 2 days when we were trying to pinpoint exactly how far up into the catchment on the River Rinda these big salmon were going. And that was great because it was a little bit of detective work. We were trying from the air to pinpoint the sort of habitat that we were going to survey. Then we were popping down with the helicopter, spending 5 or 10 minutes looking at what we were picking up in terms of juvenile salmon and then going to the next bit. And we thought we were running out of fish. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, we found this beautiful piece of river between two lakes, which was, you know, tens of kilometres away from anything else that we had seen. And there was a fantastic population of juvenile salmon. And my colleague said to me, I wonder if there's any adults about. And I said, there's only one way to find out. So I put up the fly rod and I had a salmon in about 3 or 4 minutes. So those fish had made their way up through all of these different environments. And nature is well able to take care of that. And it was a great lesson to me that really what we should be doing is observing and helping it along, not actually interfering and trying to prejudge what way these catchments should be as such, you know.
Who's paying for all of this survey work, Ken?
Well, interestingly, the survey work was all being paid for by the private owners on the fisheries, because the fisheries are so valuable to them. They want to make absolutely certain that these fisheries are in pristine condition. And when they advertise a product, whether they're bringing people over to fish for trout or char or whatever, that these fisheries have everything that they're advertising. So what they do is they subcontract the Polar Research Institute to spend 2 or 3 months of the year doing survey work on the rivers. And there's a big program that's just completed now between Russia, Finland and Norway called the Coal-Arctic program. And it came after the big Salsi program that I've talked about on the program here before. And I helped them with the setup of that particular program. And they very kindly then invited me to come over and see some of the survey work that was ongoing to tie in with some of the showing me how it ties in with some of the results that they found from the Coal Arctic program. So it's all very much funded at this stage from the private sector.